You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Eurythmy as Visible Speech, given in Dornach, Switzerland, from the 24th of June to the 12th of July, 1924, 15 lectures, translated by Vera and Judy Compton Burnett. It is Collected Works, Volume 279. And I'm going to read Lecture 1, but begin with a Speech Eurythmy Course report in the new sheet. I will be attempting the German at times in this, and I do apologize in advance for that. Prior to Lecture 1, Speech Eurythmy Course, report in the new sheet, Nachrichtenblatt. From June 24th to July 12th, the course of lectures on speech eurythmy was held at the Goetheanum. It had as content a further presentation of much which had already been given in this domain, and at the same time a deepening and widening of what was already known. The eurythmy artists, who both at the Goetheanum and going out from there to many places, are practicing eurythmy as an art. The eurythmy teachers, the teaching staff of the Stuttgart Eurythmy School, founded and directed by Marie Steiner, the eurythmy teachers of the Waldorf School and the Fortbildungsschule at the Goetheanum, the curative eurythmists, and the number of personalities who, through their profession as artists or scientists in other spheres, are interested in eurythmy, attended the course. Eurythmy makes it possible to bring the artistic as such, in its essence and its sources, to visible beholding. This was specially borne in mind during the presentation of this course. He only can work as eurythmy artist who creatively unfolds a sense for art from an inner call, an inner enthusiasm. In order to bring to manifestation the possibilities of form and movement inherent in the human organization, it is necessary that the soul be completely infilled with art. This universal character of eurythmy underlay all that was presented. Whoever wishes to do eurythmy must have penetrated into the being of speech formation. He must, before all, have approached the mysteries of sound creation. In every sound, an expression for a soul experience is given. In the vowel sounds, for a thinking, feeling, willing self-revelation of the soul. In the consonant sounds, for the way in which the soul represents an outer thing or a process. This expression of language remains for the most part quite subconscious in the case of ordinary speech. The eurythmist must learn to know it quite exactly, for he has to transform what becomes audible in speech into gestures which are quiescent or in movement. In this course, therefore, the inner structure of language was revealed. The sound significance of the word, which everywhere underlies the meaning significance, was made visible. By the eurythmy gestures themselves, some aspects of the inner laws of language, still little recognized at the present time, when speaking is the expression of a strongly abstract attitude of soul, can be visibly manifested. That is what happened in this course. Thereby, it may be hoped, it will also have given to eurythmy teachers the guiding lines necessary for them. The eurythmist must devote himself to the gesture down to its smallest detail, so that his performance really becomes the self-understood expression of the life of soul. He can only give form to the gesture in its fullness when the smallest detail comes first to consciousness, that it may later become the habitual expression of the soul being. A study was made of how the gesture, as such, reveals soul experience and spirit content, and also of how this revelation relates itself to the soul expression, which is manifested audibly in the language of sound. From eurythmy one can learn to value the technique of art, but from eurythmy one can indeed also become deeply imbued with the way in which the technical must put aside everything external and be completely taken hold of by the soul, if the truly artistic is to come to life. People who are active in any sphere of art often speak of how the soul must work behind the technique. The truth is that it is in the technique that the soul must work. A special value is laid in these lectures upon showing that in the truly formed gestures, the aesthetically sensitive human being perceives the soul element directly in a quite unequivocal way. Examples were shown which demonstrated how a content in the soul configuration can be made obvious in a certain gesture formation. It was also shown how the whole structure of language, which reveals itself in grammar, syntax, rhythm, in poetical figures of speech, in rhyme and verse formation, also finds its corresponding realization in eurythmy. The audience attending this course was not only to be led into the knowledge of eurythmy, but they should be brought to the experience of how all art must be sustained by love and enthusiasm. The eurythmist cannot separate himself from his artistic creation and objectively put it forward for aesthetic enjoyment, as can the painter or sculptor. But he remains personally within his performance. One sees from him himself whether or no art lives within him as a divine world content. In the immediate artistic present, art, in its visible essence, must be made manifest by the actual human being of the eurythmist. This demands a particularly inward and intimate relationship to art. To help the partakers toward this understanding was the aim of this course. It wished to show how, when beholding the gestures, feeling, inner perception are enkindled in the soul, and how this inner perception then leads to the experience of the visible world. Much which can only be partially expressed in the audible word can be completely revealed through the movements of eurythmy. The audible word in recitation and declamation, in conjunction with the visible word, produces a total expression which can result in the most intensive artistic unity. The end of the preface to Lecture 1. Lecture 1, Eurythmy as Visible Speech. These lectures dealing with the nature of eurythmy are given in response to a request from Frau Dr. Steiner, who believes it to be necessary, in order to lay the foundation of an exact eurythmic tradition, to recapitulate in the first place all that has been given in the domain of speech eurythmy at different times to different people. To this repetition, fresh material will be added in order to widen the field of eurythmic expression. Such material will, however, not be set apart in separate chapters, but will be given in connection with each individual point as this comes under discussion. I shall endeavor to deal with eurythmy from its various aspects, not only from the artistic side, which naturally calls for our first consideration here, but also from the point of view of education and healing. The first lecture will be in the nature of an introduction, and this will be followed by a lecture dealing with the first elements of speech eurythmy. In every branch of eurythmic activity, it is necessary above all that the personality, the whole human being of the eurythmist, should be brought into play, so that eurythmy may become an expression of life itself. This cannot be achieved unless one enters into the spirit of eurythmy, feeling it actually as visible speech. As in the case of all artistic appreciation, it is quite possible for anyone to enjoy eurythmy as a spectator without having acquired any knowledge of its essential basis, just as it is quite unnecessary to have studied harmony or counterpoint to be able to appreciate music. For it is an accepted fact of human evolution that the healthily developed human being carries within him a natural appreciation and understanding of art. Art must work through its own inherent power. Art must explain itself. Those, however, who are studying eurythmy, whose duty it is in some way or another to bring eurythmy before the world, must penetrate into the actual essence and nature of eurythmy, in just the same way as, let us say, the musician, the painter, or the sculptor must enter into the nature of his own particular art. If we wish to enter into the true nature of eurythmy, we must, perforce, enter into the true nature of the human being. For eurythmy, to a far greater extent than any other art, makes use of what lies in the nature of man himself. Take, for example, various other arts, arts which need instruments or tools for their expression. You find no instrument or tool so nearly akin to the human being as the instrument made use of by the eurythmist. The art of mime and the art of dancing do indeed to some extent make use of the human being as a means of artistic expression. With the art of mime, however, that which is expressed through the mime itself is merely subordinate to the performance as a whole. For such a performance does not depend entirely upon the artistic, plastic use of the human being. In such a case, this same human being is made use of in order to imitate something or other which is already represented in man here upon the earth. Further, in the case of the art of mime, we find as a rule that the gestures are used mainly to emphasize and render clearer something which is made use of by man in everyday life. That is to say, mime emphasizes speech. In order to bring a more intimate note into speech, gesture is added. Thus we are here concerned with something which merely adds, in some small measure, to the scope of that which is already present in man on the physical plane. In the art of dancing, if we may use the word art in such a connection, when dancing rises to the level of art, we have to do with an outpouring of the emotions, of the will, into movements of the human body, whereby are only further developed those possibilities of movement inherent in the human being, and already present elsewhere on the physical plane. In eurythmy, we have to do with something which can nowhere be found in the human being in ordinary physical life, but which must be through and through a creation out of the spiritual worlds. We have to do with something which makes use of the human being, which makes use of the human form and its movement as a means of expression. Now, the question arises, what is really expressed in eurythmy? This you will only understand when you begin to realize that eurythmy is actually a visible speech. With regard to speech itself, the following must be said. When we give form to speech by means of mime, the ordinary speech itself provides us with a picture, with an image. When, however, we give form to speech itself, to sound as such, we find that the latter contains within it no such image. Speech arises as a separate, independent product from out of the human being himself. Nowhere in nature do we find that which reveals itself in speech, that which comes into being through speech. For this reason, eurythmy must, in its very nature, be something which represents a primeval creation. Speech, let us take this as our starting point. Speech appears as a production of the human larynx and of those organs of speech which are more or less connected with it. What is the nature of the larynx? This question must eventually be brought forward, for I have often shown how in eurythmy the whole human being must become a sort of larynx. We must therefore put to ourselves the question of what significance is the larynx. Now, if you look upon speech merely as a production of the larynx, you will gain no conception of what is really proceeding from it, of what is being fashioned within it. Here it would perhaps be well to remind ourselves of a remarkable tradition which today is little understood, and of which you find some indication when you take the beginning of St. John's Gospel, quote, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and a God was the Word," close quote. the Word. Of course, that which we today imagine to be the Word is something which gives not the slightest sense to the opening sentences of this Gospel. Nevertheless, they are continually quoted. People believe they can make something out of them. They do not, however, succeed. For it is an undeniable fact that the conception of a word, as held by the man of today, is often truly expressed by his saying something of this kind. What is a name but mere sound and smoke, mist and vapor? In a certain sense, he values the word itself little in comparison with its underlying concept. He feels a certain superiority in thus being able to value the word little in comparison with a thought. When, therefore, one puts oneself in the position of the man of today and considers his conception of a word, the beginning of St. John's Gospel has indeed no meaning. For consider, the word? We have so many words. Which word? It can only be a definite, concrete word. And what is the nature of this word? That is the question. Now, behind this tradition, which is indicated in the beginning of this Gospel, lies the fact that man once had an instinctive knowledge of the true nature of the Word. Today, however, this knowledge has been lost. To primeval human understanding, the idea, the conception, the Word, comprised the whole human being as an etheric creation. All of you, as anthroposophists, know what we mean by the etheric man. We have the physical man and we have the etheric man. Physical man, as he is described today by modern physiology and anatomy, consists, both outwardly and inwardly, of certain forces which can be drawn. Here, however, one naturally does not take into consideration the fact that what one draws is only the very smallest part of the physical human being. For the physical body is at the same time fluidic. It consists also of air and warmth. These constituents are naturally not included when one is speaking of the human being in physiology and anatomy. Nevertheless, it is possible to gain some idea of the nature of the physical body of man. We have, however, the second member of the human being, the etheric body. If we were to attempt to draw the etheric body, something extraordinarily complicated would come to expression. For the etheric body can just as little be represented as something static as can lightning. It is impossible to paint lightning, for lightning is in continual movement, lightning is in continual flow. In portraying lightning, one must attempt to show it in continual flow and movement. And the same holds good with the etheric body. The etheric body is in continual motion, in continual activity. Now these movements, these gestures, which are continually in movement, of which the etheric body does not indeed consist, but out of which it continually arises and again passes away, do we find them anywhere in the world of man? Do we come up against them anywhere? Yes, we do. This was no secret to a primeval and intuitive knowledge. We have these movements. And here, my dear friends, I must ask you to take what I am saying quite literally. We have these movements and the sound formations which embody the content of speech. Now, review mentally all the sounds of speech to which your larynx gives form and utterance, inasmuch as this formative principle is applied to the entire range of articulate speech. Bear in mind all the component elements which issue from the larynx for the purpose of speech. You must realize that all these elements, proceeding as they do from the larynx, really form the component parts of that which is brought to outer expression in speech. You must realize that these sound formations consist of definite movements, the origin of which lies in the structure and form of the larynx and its neighboring organs. They proceed from the larynx. But these movements do not, of course, appear simultaneously. We cannot utter all the sounds which make up the content of speech at the same moment. How then could we utter all that makes up the content of speech? We could do so, paradoxical as this may sound, it is, nevertheless, a fact. We could do so if, for once, we were to utter one after the other all the possible sounds from A, B, C down to Z. Try to imagine this. Imagine that someone were to say the alphabet aloud, beginning with A, B, and continuing as far as Z, with only the necessary pauses for breathing. Every spoken sound describes a certain form in the air, which one does not see, but the existence of which must be presupposed. It is possible, indeed, to think of these forms being retained, fixed by scientific means, without actually making a physical drawing of them. When we utter any particular word aloud, tree, for example, or sun, we produce a quite definite air form. If we were to say the whole alphabet aloud, from A to Z, we should produce a very complicated air form. Let us put this question to ourselves. What really would be the result if someone were actually to do this? It would have to take place within a certain time, as you will learn in the course of these lectures. It would have to take place within a certain time, so that, on reaching Z, the first sound would not have completely disintegrated. That is to say, the A sound must still retain its plastic form when we have reached the sound Z. If it were actually possible, in this creation of air forms, to pass from A to Z in such a way that the A sound remained when the Z sound were reached, thus creating in the air an image of the whole alphabet, what would be the result? What sort of form should we have made? We should have created the form of the human etheric body. In this way, we should have reproduced the human etheric body. If you were to repeat the alphabet aloud from A to Z, one would have to do this in exactly the right way. The alphabetical order of sounds in general use today is no longer quite correct, but I am speaking now of the underlying principle. The human etheric body would stand before you. What then would really have taken place? The human etheric body is always present. Every man bears it within himself. What do you do, therefore, when you speak, when you say the alphabet aloud? You sink, so to speak, into the form of your own etheric body. What happens then when we utter a single word, which of course does not consist of all the sounds? Let us picture to ourselves the human being as he stands before us. He consists of physical body, etheric body, astral body, and ego. He speaks some word. He sinks his consciousness into his etheric body. He forms some part of the etheric body in the air as an image. In much the same way as you, standing before a physical body, might, for instance, copy the form of a hand, so that the form of the hand were made visible in the air. Now the etheric body does not consist of the same forms as those which make up the physical body. But in this case, it is the forms of the physical body which are impressed into the air. When we learn to understand this rightly, my dear friends, we gain an insight into the most wonderful metamorphosis of the human form, an insight into the evolution of man. For what is this etheric body? It is the vehicle of the forces of growth. It contains within it all those forces bound up with the processes of nourishment, and also those forces connected with the power of memory. All this is imparted to the airy formations when we speak. The inner being of man, insofar as this is expressed in the etheric body, is impressed into the air when we speak. When we put sounds together, words arise. When we put together the whole alphabet from beginning to end, there arises a very complicated word. This word contains every possibility of word formation. It also contains, at the same time, the human being in his etheric nature. Before man appeared on the earth as a physical being, he already existed as an etheric being. For the etheric man underlies the physical man. How then may the etheric man be described? The etheric man is the word, which contains within it the entire alphabet. Reader's aside, and that is the word, capital W. End of reader's aside. Let me read that sentence again. The etheric man is the word, which contains within it the entire alphabet. Thus, when we are able to speak of the formation of this primeval word, which existed from the beginning, before physical man came into being, we find that that which arises in connection with speech may indeed be called a birth of the whole etheric man when the alphabet is spoken aloud. Otherwise, in the single sounds, it is a partial birth, a birth of fragments, of parts of the human being. In every single word, as it is uttered, there lies something of the being of man. Let us take the word tree, for instance. What does it mean when we say the word tree? When we say the word tree, it means that we describe the tree in some such way as this. We say, that which stands there in the outer world, to which we give the name tree, is a part of ourselves, a part of our own etheric being. Everything in the world is a part of ourselves. Nothing exists which cannot be expressed through the being of man. Just as the human being, when he gives utterance to the whole alphabet, really gives utterance to himself, and consequently to the whole universe, so when uttering single words, which represent fragments of the collective word, of the alphabet, he gives expression to something which is a part of the universe. The entire universe would be expressed if the whole alphabet were uttered from beginning to end. Parts of the universe are expressed in the single words. There is one thing, however, about which we must be quite clear when we think over all that lies behind sound as such. Behind sound as such, there lies everything that is comprised in the inner being of man. The activity manifested by the etheric body is representative of inner experiences of the soul in the nature of feeling. We must now find our way to these feelings themselves, which are experienced in the human soul. Let us take the sound ah as a beginning. Footnote, owing to the fact that a number of German examples and quotations have had to be retained in the translation of these lectures, the German pronunciation of the vowel sounds has been consistently used throughout. End of footnote. Today one learns to utter the sound ah when one is in that unconscious dreamy condition in which one lives as a very small child. This experience is later buried when the child suffers harm at school as a result of receiving wrong teaching in sound and language. When one learns to speak as a child, there is really present something of the great mystery of speech. It remains, however, in a state of dreamy unconsciousness. When we utter the sound ah, we feel, if our instinct is at all healthy, that this sound really proceeds from our inmost being when we are in a state of wonderment and amazement. Now this wonder is, of course, again only a part of the human being. Man is no abstraction. At every waking moment of his life, he is something or other. One can, of course, allow oneself to become sluggish or stupefied, in which case one cannot be said to be anything very definite. But the human being must always be something, even when he reduces himself to a state of torpor. At every minute of the day, he must be something or other. Now he is filled with wonder, now with fear, or again, let us say, with aggressive activity. The human being is no abstraction. Every second he must be something definite. Thus there are times when man is a being of wonder, a being filled with amazement. The processes at work in the etheric body, when man experiences wonder, are imprinted into the air with the help of the larynx when he utters the sound ah. When man utters the sound ah, he sends forth out of himself a part of his own being, namely the quality of wonder. this he imprints into the air. We know that when a physical man appears upon the earth, he appears, if he is born in accordance with the ordinary possibilities of development, as a complete human being. This complete human being comes forth from the womb of the mother. He is born as physical man, with a physical form. If all the sounds of the alphabet were uttered from A to Z, there would arise an etheric man. Only this etheric man would be imprinted into the air, born from out of the human larynx and its neighboring organs. In the same way, when the child is brought into the world, when the child first sees the light, we must say, from out of the womb and its neighboring organs, there has arisen a physical man. But the larynx differs from the womb of the mother in that it is in a continual state of creation, so that in single words, fragments of a human being arise. And indeed, if one were to bring together all the words of a language, parenthesis, which even in the case of a poet of such rich vocabulary as Shakespeare never actually occurs, close parenthesis, the entire etheric man, as an air form, would be produced by means of the creative larynx. But it would be a succession of births, a continuous becoming. It would be a birth continually taking place during the process of speech. Speech is always the bringing to birth of parts of the etheric man. Again, the physical larynx is only the external sheath of that most wonderful organ which is present in the etheric body, and which is, as it were, the womb of the Word. And here again we are confronted with a wonderful metamorphosis. Everything which is present in the human being is a metamorphosis of certain fundamental forms. The etheric larynx and its sheath, the physical larynx, are a metamorphosis of the uterus. In speech we have to do with the creation of man, with the creation of man as an etheric being. This mystery of speech, my dear friends, is indicated by the connection which we find between the vocal and sexual functions, a connection clearly illustrated in the breaking of the male voice. We have therefore to do with a creative activity, which welling up from the depths of cosmic life, flows outward through the medium of speech. We see revealed in a fluctuating, ever-changing form, that which otherwise withdraws itself into the mysterious depths of the human organism at the moment of physical birth. Thus we gain something which is essential for us in our artistic creative activity. We gain respect, reverence, for that creative element into which we as artists are placed. Theoretical discussion is useless in the realm of art. We cannot do with it. It merely leads us into abstraction. In art we need something which places us with our whole being into the cosmic being. And how could we penetrate more deeply into the cosmic being than by becoming conscious of the relation existing between speech and the genesis of man? Every time that a man speaks, he produces out of himself some part of that which existed in primeval times, when the human being was created out of cosmic depths, out of the etheric forces, and received form as a being of air before he acquired fluidic form, and later still his solid physical form. Every time we speak, we transpose ourselves into the cosmic evolution of man as it was in primeval ages. Let us take an example. Let us go back once more to the sound ah, this sound which calls up within us the human being in a state of wonder. We must realize that every time the sound ah appears in language, there lies behind it the element of wonder. Let us take the word Wasser, water, or the word Pfahl, post, any word you like in which the sound ah occurs. In every instance, when you lay stress on the sound ah in speech, there lies in the background a feeling of wonder. The human being filled with wonder is brought to expression in this way by means of speech. There was a time when this was known. It was, for example, known to the Hebraic people. for what really lay behind the ah, the aleph, in the Hebrew language. What was the aleph? It was wonder as manifested in the human being. Now, I should like to remind you of something which could lead you to an understanding of all that is really indicated by the sound ah, all that the sound ah really signifies. In ancient Greece there was a saying, philosophy begins with wonder. Philosophy, the love of wisdom, the love of knowledge, begins with wonder. Had one spoken absolutely organically, really in accordance with primeval understanding, with primeval instinctive clairvoyant understanding, one might equally well have said, philosophy begins with awe. To a primeval humanity, this would have meant exactly the same thing. Philosophy, love of wisdom, begins with awe. But what is it that one is really investigating when one studies philosophy? When all is said and done, one is really investigating man. Philosophy strives after self-knowledge, and this self-observation begins with the sound ah. It is, however, at the same time, a most profound mystery, for it requires great effort, great activity, to attain to such knowledge of the human being. When man approaches his own being and sees how it is formed out of body, soul, and spirit, when he looks upon his own being in its entirety, then he is confronted by something before which he may say ah with the deepest wonder. For this reason, ah corresponds to man in a state of wonder, to man filled with wonder at his own true being, that is to say, man looked at from the highest, most ideal aspect. The realization that man, as he stands before us as a physical being, is but a part of the complete human being, and that we only have the real man before us when we perceive the full measure of the divinity within him, this realization, this wonder called up in us by a contemplation of our own being, was called by a primeval humanity, ah. Ah corresponds to man in his highest perfection. Thus, ah is man. And in the sound ah, we are expressing something which is felt in the depths of the human soul. Let us pass over from ah to b, in order to give at least some indication of that which might lead to an understanding of this primeval word, which is made up of the entire alphabet. Let us pass over to b. In b we have a so-called consonant. In a we have to do with a vowel sound. You will feel, if you pronounce a vowel sound, that you are giving expression to something coming from the inmost depths of your own being. Every vowel, as we have already seen in the case of the vowel ah, is bound up with an experience of the soul. In every case where the sound ah makes its appearance, we have the feeling of wonder. In every case where an a makes its appearance, we have an experience which can be expressed somewhat as follows. I become aware that something has been done to me. A. Just think for a moment what creatures of abstraction we have become, how withered and lifeless our nature. Just as an apple or a plum may shrivel up, so have we become shriveled up as regards our experience of language. Let us consider how, in speaking, when we pronounce the sound ah and proceed from this sound to the sound a, which constantly happens, we have no idea that we are passing over from the feeling of wonder to the feeling, I become aware that something has been done to me. Let us now enter into the feeling of the E sound. With E we have, as it were, the feeling that we have been curious about something and that our curiosity has been satisfied. A wonderful and far from simple experience lies at the back of every vowel sound. When we allow the five vowel sounds to work upon us, we receive the impression of man in his primeval strength and vigor. Man is, as it were, born again in his true dignity when he allows these five sounds consciously to work upon him. That is to say, when he allows these sounds to proceed out of his inmost being in full consciousness. Therefore, it is true to say, we have become quite shriveled up and think only of the meaning of a word, utterly disregarding the experience behind it. We think only of the meaning. The word water, for instance, means some particular thing, and so on. We have become utterly shriveled up. The consonants are quite different in their nature from the vowels. With the consonants, we do not feel that the sounds arise from our inmost experience, but we feel that they are images of that which is outside our own being. Let us suppose that I am filled with wonder, that I say, ah. I cannot make an outer image of the sound ah. I must give utterance to it. If, however, I would give expression to something which is round in its form, like this table, for example, what must I do if I do not wish to express it in words? I must imitate it. I must copy its form. Of course, and there's a corresponding gesture. If I would describe a nose without speaking, without actually saying the word nose, but still wishing to make myself understood, I can, as it were, copy its form. Again, corresponding gesture. And it is just the same in the forming of the consonants. In the consonants, we have an imitation of that which exists in the external world. They are always an imitation of external forms. But we express these forms by constructing them in the air, producing them by means of the larynx and its neighboring organs, the palate, for example. With the help of these organs, we create a form which imitates, copies something which exists outside ourselves. This is even carried into the actual form of the letters, but of this we shall speak later. When we form a B, it is, by the way, impossible to pronounce this sound without the addition of some vowel. When we form a B, it is the imitation of something in the external world. If we were to hold fast the air form which is created by B, we must, of course, speak the sound aloud, we should have something in the nature of a shelter. A protecting, sheltering form would be produced. Something would be produced which might be likened to a hut or a house. B is an imitation of a house. Thus, when we begin with a B, we have, as it were, the human being in his perfection, and the human being in his house. A, B. And so, if we were to go through the whole alphabet, we should, in the consecutive sounds, unfold the mystery of man. We should express the human being as he lives in the cosmos, the human being in his house, his physical sheath. If we were to pass from A, B, to S, D, and so on, every sound would tell us something about the human being. And on reaching z, we should have pictured in sound the whole of human wisdom, for this is contained in the etheric body of man. We see from this that something of the very greatest significance takes place in speech. In speech, the human being himself is fashioned. And one can indeed give a fairly complete picture of the soul of man, when one brings to expression his most fundamental feelings, E, O, A. These sounds represent practically the whole content of the human soul in its aspect of feeling, E, O, A. Let us for a moment consider all that proceeds from the human being when he speaks. Let us suppose that somebody repeats the alphabet. When this is done, the entire etheric body of man comes into being, proceeding from the larynx, as from the womb. The etheric body is brought into being. When we look at the physical body of man, we know that it has come forth from the organism of the mother. It has come forth from a metamorphosis of the larynx, that is to say, from the mother's womb. But now let us picture to ourselves the complete human being, as he comes into the world with all his different attributes. For that which is brought forth from the organism of the mother cannot remain unchanged. If the human being were to remain unchanged through his whole life, he could not be said to be a man in the true sense of the word. One thing must be continually added to another. The human being at the age of 35, let us say, has gained more from the universal cosmic being than was his as a child. We may picture the whole human being in some way, in some such way as this. Just as speech proceeds from out of the larynx, the child from out of the womb, so the fully developed human being at about the age of 35 is born, as it were, from out of the cosmos, in the same way in which the words which we speak are spoken out of us. Thus we have the form of man, the complete human form, as a spoken word. The human form stands before us, that most wonderful of earthly forms. The human form stands before us, and we ask the divine spiritual powers, which have existed from the beginning, how then did you create man in a similar way as the spoken word is created when we speak? How did you create man? What really took place when you created man? And if we were to receive an answer to our question from out of universal space, it would be some such answer as this. All around us there is movement, form, constantly changing and of infinite variety. Such a form, Ah was here shown in Eurythmy, such a form, A was shown, such a form, E was shown. All possibilities of form in movement proceed out of the universe. Every possibility of movement that we, out of the nature of our being, are able to conceive and to bring into connection with the human organization. My dear friends, one can indeed say that these possibilities of movement are those which, becoming fixed, give man his physical form, as it is, when he reaches full maturity. What then would the gods do if they really wished to form man out of a lump of earth? The gods would make movements, and as a result of these movements, capable of giving form to the dust of the earth, the human form would eventually arise. Now, once more, let us picture the Eurythmy movements for ah, for b, for s, and so on. Let us imagine that the gods, out of their divine primeval activity, were to make those Eurythmic movements which correspond to the sounds of the alphabet. Then, if these movements were impressed into physical matter, the human being would stand before us. This is what really lies behind Eurythmy. The human being, as we see him, is a completed form, but the form has been created out of movement. It has arisen from those primeval forms which were continually taking shape and again passing away. Movement does not proceed from quiescence. On the contrary, that which is in a state of rest originates in movement. In Eurythmy, we are really going back to a primordial movement. What is it that my Creator, working out of primeval cosmic being, does in me as man? If you would give the answer to this question, you must make the Eurythmic movements. God eurythmatizes, and as a result of his Eurythmy, there arises the form of man. What I have said here about Eurythmy can indeed be said about any of the arts, for in some way or another every art springs from a divine origin. But in Eurythmy most especially, because it makes use of the human being as its instrument, one is able to penetrate most deeply into the connection existing between the human being and the cosmic being. For this reason one cannot fail to appreciate Eurythmy. For just suppose that one had no real conception of the nature of human beauty, as this is expressed in the outward human form. And then suppose that one had the opportunity of being shown how, in the beginning, God created the beautiful human form out of movement. And one saw the repetition of those divine creative movements in the Eurythmic gestures. Then one would receive the answer to the question, how did human beauty come into being? Let us think of the child, the incomplete human being, who has not yet attained to his full manhood. How shall we help the gods? so that the physical form of the child shall be rightly furthered in its development? What shall we bring to the child in the way of movement? We must teach him eurythmy, for this is a continuation of divine movement, of the divine creation of man. And when illness of some kind or another overtakes the human being, then the forms corresponding to his divine archetype receive injury. Here in the physical world they become different. What shall we do then? We must go back to those divine movements. We must help the sick human being to make those movements for himself. This will work upon him in such a way that the harm his bodily form may have received will be remedied. Thus we have to look upon eurythmy as an art of healing, just as in ancient clairvoyant times it was known that certain sounds, uttered with a special intonation, reacted upon the health of man. But in those days one was shown how to affect the health by a more or less roundabout way, by means of the air, which worked back again into the etheric body. If one works more directly, if one makes the patient actually do the movements corresponding to the formation of his organs, the point being, of course, that one knows what these movements really are. For example, certain movements of the foot and leg correspond to certain formations right up in the head, close parenthesis. When one reproduces all this, then there arises this third aspect of eurythmy, curative eurythmy. This introduction was necessary in order that all of you, as active eurythmists, may gain a fundamental feeling and perception of what you are doing. You must not take eurythmy as something which can be learned in the ordinary conventional way, but you must think of it as something which brings the human being nearer to the divine than would otherwise be possible. The same applies indeed to all art. You must permeate yourselves through and through with this feeling. What then must be considered as an essential part of all eurythmic teaching? The right atmosphere must enter into it, the feeling for the connection between man and the divine spiritual powers. This is essential, if you would become eurythmists in the true sense. The end of Lecture 1.